In this first hour of the show, we will spend some time talking about current issues in civil liberties. And our guest for the program is Ed Yonka. He's the communications director for the Illinois chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. He will be in Champaign-Urbana coming up this weekend on Sunday, that's the 18th, and he will be the speaker at the annual dinner of the Champaign County chapter of the ACLU. So if you're here in the area, it is possible to attend. You can do that, but of course, here on the show, as we talk, if you have questions, comments, you'd like to get involved in the conversation, you can certainly do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. And in fact, if you would happen to be listening on the Internet, anybody in the United States could use that and could call in. So that's 800-222-9455. If you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. The same numbers as always. And we'll say here hello to Ed Yonka. Mr. Yonka, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I think I'm okay. I don't know. I might have to reassess here every couple of minutes. We appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
For people like you, people who are involved in ACLU, obviously your brief is to think about civil liberties all the time. And I guess whenever I have a conversation with someone like you, I'd feel that we could start out with some kind of global question, and I kind of suspect I know what the answer is, and that is to talk a little bit about the current state of civil liberties and whether we have reason to be, I suppose somebody like you would say, we always have reason to be vigilant, but whether at this point where we are, particularly post 9/11, we have even more reason to be concerned about civil liberties.
Well, sure. Can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
I'm getting like some music in the background. It is making it hard for me to hear you. I don't.
We're not doing that on purpose.
Okay.
I know my board operator here is sort of shaking his head, and he's not really sure what's going on.
Okay.
We'll try real hard to make sure that we fix it.
That'd be great. Just if you could make sure that you speak up, it'd be much easier for me to hear you.
Okay. Okay.
I think there is always an issue, as people think about these things, that we do always need to be concerned about our civil liberties. There is probably, I think, something inherent in us as a people over the last more than two centuries as we've wrestled through this constitutional system that we cherish, that there are always questions that are before us. There are always things that we are going to be looking at and steps that people are going to take because they think them expedient at a particular moment that, in fact, do have a detrimental impact upon our civil liberties and on our basic constitutional rights. This moment, I think, seems particularly troubling because I think this may be a time when we see really two things coming together that are particularly troubling. There are really two kinds of protections of our civil rights and civil liberties that are contained in our Constitution. There are the enumerated rights that I think most of us think of that are in the Bill of Rights, the freedom of speech, the protections against unreasonable search and seizure, the right to counsel, the right to a public trial, the right to know the evidence against you. All of those things really have been under attack in a very significant way since 9/11. The Patriot Act, for example, really provides for this broad sweeping power for searches and seizures of material from people based on a level of evidence or a level of proof that's far below any standard of reasonable suspicion or probable cause. You have the new FBI guidelines that really allow for the kind of scrutiny of people, oftentimes based on their ideology or their political background or their political activities. And then finally, I think you have a number of different things that are going on that affect individuals in terms of those kinds of scrutinies, then often dampening or tamping down their legitimate First Amendment activity. So those rights are under scrutiny and I think under duress. The problem is that the overlay of that is that the very structural protections that were put into place also are very much under siege. As a matter of fact, within the next 10 days or 2 weeks, the Supreme Court of the United States will hear two cases. On April 20th, the Guantanamo case, or I should say two arguments. On April 20th, the Guantanamo case, and on April 28th, the matter involving the so-called enemy combatants who are U.S. citizens, in which, in point of fact, the government of the United States is arguing that the courts have no role in overseeing the validity of detention of people on U.S. soil. And that undermining, I think, of the courts really heightens concerns about the degree to which we are respecting individual rights and individual liberties at this point, because there will always be, I think, some repression of rights that will exist. But the problem is that when you take the courts out of the equation of being the arbiters of that, I think that's when you really have the danger that the executive branch can overreach and overextend.
We can try and get back to some of these questions and others for people who are listening. I have a caller when we're going to get to. I just want to ask Mr. Yonka, did we take care of the music there? Is that
you did. You did. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much.
Our apologies. We weren't exactly sure why that happened, but occasionally you get things
right.
Things sort of cross. And, you know, we have this board here in our control room that has about 172 channels on there, so sometimes things get goofed up. Our guest in this part of the show, Ed Yonka, he's communications director for the Illinois chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, and questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We have a caller here who obviously is listening on the internet because he's in San Francisco. We'll go there to our toll-free line number four. Hello.
Yes, hey, morning. I was interested in two different aspects of this. In one case, it's the rise of religion and how Bush and his constant theological use of "we are fighting evil" is very much confounding to the Bill of Rights, that virtually every one of the Bill of Rights were founded to compete against the old Inquisition days, that essentially if you were accused of being inhabited by the devil, that you were not allowed to have a trial by jury because the jury, the devil might jump out of you and jump in the jury, that you were not entitled to have an attorney because the devil, the attorney would be pleading the case for the devil, that the can't have the right to a public trial because the devil might jump into the public. You can't have the judge could have a hood over his head because the devil might jump into the judge. And that virtually every one of the Bill of Rights were based upon the evil that came from the Inquisition days. And I wonder if you had any comment on that. The second thing, here in San Francisco last night, we had a conference on the impeachment of Bush. And one of the professors that spoke was talking specifically about that the wartime, that Congress, when they granted Bush essentially war powers to do this war without end, were abdicating their own duties, and that they had no right to grant Bush this these war powers. That it's obvious that he used weapons of mass destruction to give an excuse to do his attack into Iraq, and apparently the way that the war powers have been granted Bush is that in the past, when we invaded Grenada, when we invaded Honduras and whatnot, the current state of it said that the president has the right to act for something like 30 days, but then the president has to go to Congress. In this case, it's been written such a way that Congress cannot have any further oversight. It cannot have War Powers Act because it already granted Bush the ability to do a war on terror forever, essentially. Bush and his boys keep talking about a war without end. And as that goes, Bush is apparently doing a war against evil. And then that brings up the original precept that these Bill of Rights that we've got are very much based upon this fraud of fighting evil, something that cannot be proven, and then is a madness in its own right as it goes to a structure of a society.
Well, two interesting, complicated questions. Mr. Yonke, you want to take a shot at that?
Sure. I think the caller does raise an interesting. Let me take them in reverse order. Raises. I think if I can kind of weave these together, raises an interesting notion. Because I think whether or not the war on terror is waged under the construct of the kind of religious. Some of the religious language that we've heard and clearly that we heard again last night from the president, or whether it is articulated in the form of, a simple kind of super patriotism. The problem is that those kinds of arguments often lead to a sense that any ends justify the means. And so I think one of the things that we've seen and one of the things that is most disconcerting is the degree to which people seem willing to accept, serious and really intrusive diminutions on their own rights, somehow under the notion that this is all protecting us, that this is all for good, because we're good and they're bad. That it makes sense to act out and to act in the ways that we have and to do anything to engage that. And I think that's very troubling when we simply suggest that somehow there is any reason and any justification or rationale for somehow changing our most basic rights and our most basic really constitutional values and principles. The other part of it is that I do think that this notion oftentimes of and this I think what the caller identifies as this religiosity of the president and some of those around him has manifested itself in a whole variety of ways over the last 3 years that are troubling and should probably give us all pause for concern. The president, for example, has gone about the country pushing the notion or the idea of these faith-based programs and has acted in a fashion to argue that the courts and others have not allowed faith-based communities to participate fully in the work of trying to help their communities in getting federal aid or doing federal projects. That's simply not true. It never has been true. And in fact, the only, sort of controls that have ever been placed on that is that the faith-based groups, by the way, hundreds of which do this every single day across the country, could not be discriminatory in their services, either in the provision of services or in their employment of people on the basis of those individuals' religious views, nor could they compel people to practice a particular religion in order to get the services. These kinds of social services that we recognize as being important. The president sort of glides over that and really seems to suggest that we ought to somehow eliminate the notion of people having religious liberty, that they ought to have the right to decide when and where they pray in order to provide these services, again, because they're important. And I think that's just another example of where there seems to be, again and again, this notion that the ends justify the means and that somehow the rules that we've lived by should no longer apply. I think those are very dangerous concepts.
Well, I appreciate the comment of the caller. Again, I want to tell other people who are listening, if you have questions, you want to call in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. I want to ask you a question, going back here to the criticisms that have been made of the Bush administration having to do with their treatment of people that they have arrested in connection with the war on terror. And the criticism is that what the administration has done is take the traditional rights of the accused and basically thrown them out the window. Their justification for doing this is that they're concerned that by providing access of reporters or family members or attorneys to the accused, that there would be the possibility of exchange of information, and that also if the identity of these people or how they were apprehended or how what we think what role we think they have in organizations like Al-Qaeda, if that becomes public, then that's information that the enemy, quote unquote, could use. And so those are all offered as justifications for essentially holding people incommunicado, not charging them, not allowing them access to attorneys and so forth. Those kinds of concerns, however, must apply to other cases where people are charged with some kind of ongoing criminal conspiracy. And I guess I wonder, in a more traditional kind of case like that, how it is that you deal with the same sorts of concerns.
Well, and I think your point is exactly right. We have seen these concerns over the course of our history in a whole range of cases. Remember that what the administration has done, I think in absolutely the way you describe it, is to argue that somehow our traditional justice system, which has protected us, helped to regulate our economy, ensured domestic tranquility in this country by giving a venue for dispute resolution that doesn't involve violence, that somehow that system that we have trusted for this long, that has been so critical to the operation of our government, can't be trusted to keep us safe. That's what they've said. It can't be trusted to keep us safe. We can't trust courts. We can't trust lawyers. We can't trust judges. We can't trust jurors. We can't trust any of the things that we have traditionally relied upon in this country as being important to our operation as a free and open society. And yet, we have somehow dealt with the most critical kinds of cases in our justice system. We have, for example, and I think, you know, most people recognize, you know, we've been fighting, say, organized crime for years. Concerns always exist in trials regarding organized crime about the safety, and I think justifiably so, the safety and protection of jurors. Yet we have tried hundreds of those cases and managed to protect jurors. We have managed to try drug kingpin cases, cases involving espionage without revealing state secrets, and things from a national perspective or national security perspective that we legitimately would want to protect and assure that they don't come out in the public. There are vehicles for doing that, but they happen inside a courtroom. What the administration has essentially decided is that they don't want to trust the courts, that they don't want to trust our courtrooms to do the work that they have traditionally done. And we see that, you know, not just in the cases of, I think most people will recognize, of Mr. Hamdi and Padilla, who are the individuals who are being held literally incommunicado under circumstances that, I think for most of us, had you described them to us years ago, we would have been virtually assured that you were describing a circumstance from, say, Stalinist Russia as opposed to the United States. But in point of fact, you know, we have tried all of these cases, or I'm sorry, that we see these in a number of different examples, whether it is the people who are being detained at Guantanamo, who we simply say have no right to any kind of due process, whether it involves the individuals who were swept up in immigration sweeps immediately after 9/11, you know, that the administration has argued they couldn't even release their names because Al-Qaeda might find out. When that was rejected by a federal judge and they had no argument around that protection, they argued once that they were trying to protect these individuals' privacy, I guess somehow taking someone into custody and holding them incommunicado doesn't violate their privacy, but letting people know that you're doing it somehow would violate that privacy. We have seen it in a whole host of ways that they have reacted and treated individuals in these kinds of detention situations. And yet the odd thing is that you know, for example, you take the somewhere between 1 and 2,000 people who were swept up off the streets in the days immediately after 9/11, and not a single one of those individuals was ever charged with being a terrorist or being involved in a crime of terrorism. The fact is that all of this is just a reaction and an overreaction in a way that is not thoughtful, is not considered, does not apply due process, and so in the end really doesn't make us any safer. And so, you know, that ought to be, as a beginning, our yardstick ought to be that we obviously abide by our most fundamental and cherished constitutional principles. But the second yardstick clearly ought to be that we at least do things that make us safer, and not simply things that violate people's fundamental rights and don't add any value at the end of the day.
We have someone else to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? And this caller is in Normal, Illinois, on our line 4, toll-free. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is something altogether different. This is a local thing that I'd like to talk to you about since you're from Illinois.
Sure.
About a year ago, a young boy in Streeter, Illinois, was murdered. The case is still unsolved. A task force of about 50 or 60 law enforcement people, FBI, state police, and other people descended on LaSalle County. And they've been doing these roadside checks, and something like they've issued over 600 tickets and arrested over 40 people for completely unrelated matters, and they won't say what they're looking for. And the black community in Streeter says they're being harassed mentally and physically. And I was wondering if the ACLU was involved at all in Streeter in this matter. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
I can say that that's not a matter that I'm familiar with. It is just as a side note to this. I think it is unfortunate to note that earlier in this term, the Supreme Court issued a ruling in a case that came out of Illinois, out of suburban Chicago, that provided or allowed the police to conduct these kinds of roadside informational gathering or set up these kind of informational roadblocks and then use those as a predicate for making other kinds of arrests and circumstance like that. So depending on not knowing anything about this, it's a little hard to say, but depending on what it is that they're looking for, what the justification is for setting up the roadblocks, it's hard to know whether or not they would meet the Supreme Court's test that they set forth in that case. One of the things that I think the caller does point out and is remarkably important about all of this is that, of course, these are exactly the kinds of circumstances that lead to the possibility of people of color being singled out for particular scrutiny, and I think that give us all pause about the use of police powers unchecked without that kind of individualized suspicion and individualized justification for conducting any stop or any search.
We are at our midpoint here. Our guest is Ed Yonka. He's Communications Director for the Illinois Chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU. He'll be, by the way, this weekend here in Champaign-Urbana to speak at the annual dinner of the Champaign County Chapter of the ACLU. That's on Sunday. It's taking place at the Illinois Terminal Building. So it is open to the public. You do need to register, however. You don't need to be a member of the ACLU to go. He's spending a little time here talking with us this morning to talk about some of the same kind of issues. I'm sure some of the things that he'll be talking about this weekend. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Just to return to the issue of this sort of larger issue about civil liberties and the atmosphere after September 11th, 2001, you have talked about this package of legislation that passed in rather short order after September 11th passed the Congress. The thing is, the shorthand is the Patriot Act.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this was last year, maybe early in the year, a draft of additional legislation, which some people called Patriot Act II, began to circulate. It hasn't, as far as I know, it hasn't been formally introduced, but it's what some people in the government would like to do. If, take it just that one step further. And I know a lot of people were concerned about it, the people who are concerned about the aspects of Patriot Act I. And even I think some members of Congress have started to look at what it is they passed and ask questions about whether or not that was the right response, and have even gone further as to say, I don't think we need to, not only do we not need to go any further than that, but we may indeed, maybe we should revisit the whole idea of the Patriot Act. And I guess I wonder, as far as you follow it, how people in Washington, particularly in Congress, are thinking now about the Patriot Act, and indeed whether there might be any kind of interest in Congress of revisiting that and looking at some of the provisions and perhaps saying that that now, given careful thought and reflection, you'd say, no, we shouldn't have done that.
I think there is a lot of rethinking about the Patriot Act and its implications in Congress, and let me give you three quick examples of that. The first is the one that you mentioned, which is that the Department of Justice drafted in early 2003 a draft legislation called the Domestic Security Enhancement Act of 2003, what some have dubbed Patriot II. Patriot II, frankly, made Patriot I look like a walk in the park. It included things like giving the Attorney General the authority to approve warrantless searches, warrantless surveillance. It provided for the stripping of citizenship of anyone who was believed to have provided material support to a terrorist organization. It allowed the government to engage in a host of other surveillance activities, as well as providing immunity for law enforcement officers who violated the civil or constitutional rights of individuals. It gave them immunity both in a civil and criminal setting as long as they were acting on the orders of their superiors. And it also contained, for the first time that we had seen, some actual punishments and some criminal actions that would have resulted from someone engaging in what is called domestic terrorism, and that's a definition that comes out of the Patriot Act, which quite candidly is far broader than anything and encompasses people engaged really in civil disobedience. And so that thing, that draft even, and the release of that draft was something that was of great concern to many people who were concerned about civil liberties. But I think what's instructive in terms of your question is the way that it was responded to on Capitol Hill, which was that, in effect, members of Congress, Republican and Democrat alike, came together and said, no thanks. And essentially told the administration that there was no reason to bring the measure forward because it wouldn't pass through this Congress. The next example of, I think, the way in which this there's sort of been this shift and change in mindset is that you may recollect that earlier this year, at the time of the State of the Union message, the president used that statement as an opportunity to push now, as opposed to waiting, to make permanent some parts of the Patriot Act that are set to expire at the end of 2005. That legislation has gone nowhere. Even though the president made it a priority, included it in the State of the Union message, again, members on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats alike, have simply said that they don't want to see that legislation go forward. They're looking forward to a full and complete debate next year about whether or not the parts of the Patriot Act should be continued. And then finally, we see that the House last summer, acted to strip from the funding authorization for the Justice Department any funding that would have been used to exercise and execute so-called sneak and peek warrants or delayed notification warrants, which has been another issue within the Patriot Act that has garnered a great deal of attention and controversy. That measure passed overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives, and again passed on a wide bipartisan vote. We hear all the time from members of Congress who I think are doing some very serious rethinking about the Patriot Act and its implications, who want the administration to answer questions about why these broad sweeping law enforcement powers were really necessary after September 11th. And I think one of the things that has come out of this, quite frankly, has been a strong sense. Again, and I want to underscore this one more time, on both sides of the aisle, that there is a need, even in a time when we feel threatened, that there is a compelling and overwhelming need for us to defend and protect these most basic of American values. That, in fact, we can't, even just because we're afraid, we can't turn our back on those principles that are most important, and that in fact we suggest that we want to have emulated around the world. And I think that has been a very good development in terms of this. And I think what it sets up, quite candidly, is a debate and a discussion next year about the continuation of the provisions of the Patriot Act, which I think Americans all across the country will have an opportunity to take a look at what's being done, take a look at what's being said, take a look at the promises that the Justice Department has made in terms of saying that they would be cautious and not violate people's civil rights or civil liberties in enforcing these things, and then see what the real truth was once they were put into action.
We have another caller here to talk with, Champaign County, and the caller is on line one. We'll go there. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, sort of a comment and a question. One of the things that's going on with these hearings is both Condoleezza Rice and our Pejorius, I guess, our Attorney General, who is apparently conflicting reports that say that he's actually being committing perjury anyway, but... they're using this whole wall of separation to applaud the Patriot Act, and it's a gambit, I think, that they've planned out. I don't know how it's playing, but I don't want to digress too much on that, but that's just a comment that they are using this current thing. It's supposed to be investigating, the culture of the FBI and CIA and the arrogance and the non-bureaucratic follow-ups and all that, and they're trying to blame it on some... just dismiss these legalisms as if they don't have any importance. But I don't know if you want to comment on that. But my question is could you just sort of survey the kind of things that's going on? You mentioned Padilla and the other case. That's a violation of habeas corpus that has nothing to do with the Patriot Act. It's just done by fiat, basically. We have the 786 or so... resident aliens and people who are out of status. You mentioned that only a handful. I think it's probably two at the most were actually related to anything that had to do with terrorism. So it was basically just a big sweep that's probably alienated more people than it's helped round up. And then there's the Guantanamo people, which is not actually, it's more of a violation of the Geneva Accords and international law than anything in American civil liberties. I mean, they conflate all these things and make the Guantanamo people need a lawyer, like because people here should have right to a lawyer. But it's not that at all. That has to do with the Geneva Accords. There has to be some kind of formal legalistic sort of assessment of what their status is. So I just would like for you to elaborate on all those three categories of current violations, and at least that's the way I see it, and to because I have they get conflated and mixed up all the time, so it'd be great if you could just do some exposition on that. Thank you.
All right.
Sure. Let me talk for just a moment. I think that people have been hearing a lot about this quote wall of separation between intelligence investigations and criminal investigations in the FBI over the past few days, and certainly was, I think, at the core of much of the Attorney General's testimony yesterday. I think that one of the things that is interesting about the discussion around this is that somehow whenever this topic comes up, that supporters of the current administration attempt to suggest somehow that that wall, the wall, to the extent it ever really existed, existed as a mechanism for trying to inhibit legitimate investigations. And nothing could be further from the truth. The fact is that essentially what happened was, as many of those of us who are old enough to remember, was that during the 1970s and the 1960s and 1970s and into the and into the late 1970s, both the FBI and the CIA were engaged in this country in investigations of people based solely on their legitimate First Amendment activities. And that when that was revealed, the public rose up and assuredly said that that had to be stopped. And so it was. And it was stopped in part part of the solution and part of the fix was to create the so-called Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which would provide for domestic surveillance in areas and issues where someone might be involved in representing a foreign power or acting on behalf of a foreign power. The fact of the matter is that the separation existed because the standard for getting permission to do surveillance of someone under FISA was far lower than the standard was in a traditional criminal setting. And so in order to create some protection that you couldn't simply use FISA as a vehicle for launching a criminal investigation when you really didn't have probable cause, they created this wall of separation. That wall that everybody talks about and again has been the subject of so much discussion, has absolutely nothing to do with the way in which various agencies did or did not interact with one another. The fact of the matter is that none of those agencies were prescribed from sharing information. They simply didn't as a matter of bureaucratic policy. And that's not something that created that in any way needed or required any statutory fix before or after 9/11. The other issues that were raised, I think, in terms of thinking through some of the things that are going on, as I mentioned earlier, the case of Jose Padilla that will be coming before the Supreme Court of the United States, essentially you have the administration arguing that a citizen can be held in the United States without charges, without access to counsel, without a right to a trial, without a right to know the charges against them, without being able to see family, without being able to have any contact with the outside world, and that this is something that they cannot find, I think, really a justification for in any way, shape, or form. But it's simply, I think, as the caller had indicated, just a right that they claim. In fact, it's interesting in the particular case of Padilla and Hamdi and these ongoing detentions without charges. It is a fact that in 1971. The Congress of the United States actually acted to overturn an old law that would have allowed the detention of American citizens without charges, and they specifically spoke to this issue and said, "This can never happen. This can never take place." Somehow, it's curious that the administration seems to think there's a question about what the status of all this is when Congress has spoken to it. And then quickly, I think we've seen, as the caller indicates, a number of issues over the last couple of years where the administration really has not served us well in terms of its interaction with a variety of different communities, especially the Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities. These are people who, quite frankly, these are communities that we need at this moment, that we need to help us ensure that we can be safe, that we need in order to help do investigations and to help see if there are people in this country who do want to do us harm. And instead of figuring out the ways in which we could bring these individuals and these communities more closer to work more closely with us and to help and to assist in terms of these kinds of investigations. We seem to have figured out every possible way we could to drive them even further away. And there have been examples from the first hours after 9/11 when agents fanned out across the country and did these massive sweeps of people and took them into custody. Again, people who had no links to terrorism whatsoever just simply disappeared. And we've also seen this then in the questioning of individuals by law enforcement agencies, in which people, these are individuals who often come from countries in which there is no such thing as a voluntary conversation with the local law enforcement agent, and yet we've tried to suggest that somehow these kinds of activities and this kind of coercion has created new ties with these communities. It's just a horrific situation, and I think the reality is, if you actually talk to law enforcement officials at the state or the local level, they will argue that the wedge that has been driven between federal law enforcement and community, South Asian and other communities, has actually, I think, created a circumstance where we are in more danger of attack than we are in terms of having gone any further in protecting ourselves.
We have another caller I get right to for the benefit of people who might have tuned in the last 20 minutes or so. I do want to reintroduce our guest. You're listening to Ed Yonka. He is communications director for the Illinois chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. He'll be here in town this weekend to speak at the annual dinner of the Champaign County chapter of the ACLU. That's on Sunday, April 18th. By the way, if you have access to the internet and you're interested in learning more about the organization, the Illinois ACLU, you would also like to find out if there is a regional chapter, and there are a number of them, you can go to the Illinois ACLU website and look at all that information. It's www.aclu-il.org. You can find out what the organization is up to, the issues that it's tracking, and also get that information on whether or not there's a chapter that's close to you, wherever you happen to be around the state. We have some other callers here, and we'd be happy to bring them into the conversation and go next to Savoy, close here to Champaign-Urbana, line number one.
I have a comment and a question, and I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer. I haven't heard the entire discussion, but I certainly appreciated your last comment about how we've alienated groups who might be assisting us in this quote-unquote war on terrorism. My question is, can you speak to whether Patriot 1 and 2 are muzzling government agencies who may in the past have spoken to the media? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Muzzling government agencies who in the past may have spoken to the media, I would be hard-pressed to think of examples of that activity. I would be hard-pressed, I think, to think of examples of government agencies being muzzled as the result of the Patriot Act, except to this extent. It's not a Patriot Act issue, but it's closely related. One of the other things that we have seen since 9/11 is that this administration's over-reliance on secrecy has frankly become almost obsessive. And one of the elements of that that I think is most troubling is that the administration has really limited the ability of all of us as Americans to get access to information about how our government is acting, behaving, and what policies it is taking in our name. So one of the things that we've seen is a real difficulty in terms of accessing information through the Freedom of Information Act. To the extent that one of the ways in which government agencies would often speak to the media is by responding to these Freedom of Information Act requests, we have certainly seen a great limitation on their ability to do that.
All right. Hope that gets at the question of the call. Let's go to Bloomington, Indiana, line number four. Hello.
Hi, 2 points. First, I don't think prisoners of war have ever had rights to due process. That's point number one. And second, our government since 9/11 has, how shall we say, avoided any further attacks on our country by terrorists. And apparently the way they've been able to avoid those attacks is by making everyone who would like to attack us, or almost everybody who would like to attack us, a prisoner of war. In other words, they incarcerate them in Cuba so they can't attack us. I think that's pretty good.
Well, Mr. Yonker, what do you think?
Well, let me say this. First of all, in terms of the Guantanamo circumstance, it's not clear that all of the individuals who are being held in Guantanamo are, in fact, prisoners of war. They've never received that designation. The actual designation of being a prisoner of war does carry with it specific rights and specific opportunities that the American government has frankly denied to the individuals who are being held at Guantanamo. I also might mention, I think one of the things that's interesting about the Guantanamo circumstance is that I think all of us, many of us I should say, because I think it includes me oftentimes, have often thought that the people who are held at Guantanamo are simply those people who were rounded up in the military battlefields of Afghanistan. It turns out, as you read the papers in these cases, that's not true. That in point of fact, some of the people who are being held at Guantanamo are people who were swept up off the streets of different countries, who were taken into custody in a variety of different ways that are not related to Guantanamo. And so I think the question of whether or not whether or not that they are prisoners of war, what status they have, is something that's not clear. The issue really before the court in the Guantanamo case is whether or not we are going to fulfill our treaty obligations to provide the mere kind of due process that is required in the Geneva Convention and other international agreements, which says that you have to give or provide some sort of process to these individuals. It doesn't have to be due process, but it has to be some sort of process to determine what the status is of individuals that you're holding, and that is something that the administration has resisted. In terms of the other part of the question and whether or not I think it's one thing one often hears, we lived in this country for a number of years without a terrorist attack. We had a terrorist attack, and now we've gone for some period without it. I don't think that the lack of a terrorist attack actually demonstrates that we have gained the upper hand on the basis of our detention policies. In fact, I think as indicated earlier, we have often detained people for lengthy periods of time who have not been demonstrated to have anything to do with terrorism. And the other thing is that we have simply said, especially in the case of Padilla and Hamdi, which is coming before the Supreme Court, that quite frankly, if these people are bad people, and they may well be, we have a way of dealing with bad folks in this society. We put them on trial, and we hold cases, and we convict them, and we put them away. We've done that with everybody from Timothy McVeigh to Manuel Noriega. I cannot believe that there is some sort of justification that suggests that we don't have the means or the will to do it with people like Jose Padilla or Hamdi. And what's really disturbing is when you read the government's arguments as to why they won't do this, it's not for an ongoing kind of protection. It's not to prevent a specific attack, but rather they fundamentally argue that they have to detain these people so that they can continue questioning and gather information from them. It is, I think, a little frightening to consider what kind of questioning they are doing that has to take place outside of the presence of a lawyer.
I hope the caller will forgive me. I have to jump in here because we're coming to the point where we have maybe about 2 minutes left. Maybe just as a way of wrapping up, it seems to me that since September 11th, we have had in this country a more broad and spirited discussion of these kind of issues, of civil liberties issues, than we had in a long time. At least it seems to me going back to maybe the time of the Vietnam War. was the last time that we seemed to be talking about these things this intensely. And it seems that you'd have to say, on one level, that's a good thing. I mean, do you think that that is true?
I do, David. I do. I think that, you know, I think one of the things that we did very poorly, and by we, I mean all of us, including, and I count among them myself as someone who does this professionally, I don't think we did a very good job in this country for years of making clear to young people and to others and to really all of us why these liberties and why these rights are important. And one of the things that I think has been a byproduct of the fact that so many of them have been under attack is that perhaps it has built a deeper appreciation of all of these rights for all people in the United States. And I think you're correct in that we have been able then to have a dialogue about why they're important, about why they matter, not just in some abstract academic sort of fashion, although I think those discussions are always valid as well, but not in just some abstract academic fashion about the particulars of the right at the margins, but really what these rights mean to us broadly as a society. And I do think that's been positive, and I do think that that has been something which, frankly, has been good. And I'll tell you the other thing. What it does is, and what happens as the result of that, is that more and more Americans, I think, really begin to understand how fundamental these are to this system of law and this system of justice that we hold so dear. And I think when people have an opportunity to do that, they respond in a thoughtful way. I think they are considerate. I think they're considered, and I think that they're ready to carry on a debate and a dialogue to fight and protect those rights.
Well, there we will leave it with our thanks to our guest, Ed Yonka. He's communications director for the Illinois ACLU. He will be in Champaign County this weekend here in Champaign-Urbana to speak at the annual dinner of the Champaign County chapter of the Illinois ACLU. Mr. Yonka, thank you very much.
Thank you, David, and I'm looking forward to being back in Champaign.